welcome to another episode of the Telltale Heart, the Pharmacist Cardiovascular Digest, and we are covering day 2 and 3 of the European Society of Congress 2026. I've titled this Treat Earlier, Implement Better, and the Questions We Thought We Knew. I'm your host, Craig Beavers. As always, if you like our content, like, subscribe, follow, send us feedback, rate us. We're always trying to improve, so please let us know. Well, let's take an unpacking look of the next few days that we saw at Munich. So if day 1 gave us important questions about precision medicine, day 2 and day 3 gave us conversations about an even more practical message. Knowing what works isn't enough. We have to identify the right patient, intervene at the right time, and build systems capable of actually delivering evidence-based care. Today, we're going to move across the entire cardiovascular continuum. I've been doing these episodes solo to try to be efficient and give you timely information and opinions. However, in the next few weeks, we'll obviously go with some other experts and KOLs to unpack, and obviously because we're going to be able to put these in context with other trials and conferences that are going on throughout the space. It is conference season the next several months, and we'll have lots of great updates and things going on. We'll start with prevention, ask a question clinicians have struggled with for years. And personally, I've been very excited about the trial that we're going to talk about over years, and that's the STARI trial. And the question is, should we start statins for prevention after age 70? Then we'll go almost to the opposite end of the spectrum after we talk about STARI and talk about the Munston and ask whether we're waiting too long to intensify lipid therapy after an acute myocardial infarction or acute coronary syndrome. I think one trial that was super fascinating to me that I wasn't putting on my radar was REACT, and it will change how we identify atherosclerotic in the first place, or atherosclerosis in the first place. Then we'll move into thrombosis. We'll examine anticoagulation after intracranial hemorrhage in the ENRICH AF trial, factor 11A inhibitors in acute coronary syndrome in the Librexa ACS trial, immediate aspirin withdrawal after Stimium in the Premium trial, and Prasugrel versus Tagular in the Switch Sweetheart. Then we're going to move into an area I think that deserves much, much more attention and that I care about a lot is implementation science. We'll talk about EMAIL-HF, the ADHERE ASCVD study, and TIME-HF. These studies are asking something deceptively simple. We already know many therapies work. How do we actually get them to patients on them and keep them? And we'll also revisit some of our familiar therapies in heart failure, hydralazine and isosorbide dinitrate and HF, and accompanying meta-analysis and metformin in MET-HFT. And finally, we'll finish with Escaza Tavi and the continuing debate about antithrombotic therapy after transcatheter aortic valve replacement or implantation. There's a lot here, so let's get started. So, STARI. Do statins still matter for primary prevention after age 70? Let's begin with what I think is one of the most clinically important prevention trials from ESC 2026. STARI, or statins for reducing events in the elderly, in this trial addressed a question that comes up consistently in clinical practice. Imagine a 72, 75, or 80-year-old patient. They're active, they're living independently, they don't perceive or appear to have established ASCVD or atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. They don't have diabetes, maybe their LDL is 130 or 140. They have hypertension and perhaps some other cardiovascular risk factors, but they've never had a myocardial infarction or stroke. Should we start a statin? For younger adults, we have decades of randomized evidence, but once we move beyond age 70, and particularly beyond age 75, the randomized evidence becomes surprisingly limited. Older adults are often underrepresented in many of our pivotal primary prevention trials, and that uncertainty has created an interesting situation in practice. Sometimes age 75 is almost a pharmacologic cliff. You're 74, let's talk about prevention. You're 76, suddenly we wonder whether it's worth treating. Biologically, that doesn't make much sense. STARI was designed specifically to address that evidence gap. So let's jump in and who was studied. STARI was a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial conducted through general practices across Australia. Investigators enrolled 9,971 community-dwelling adults aged 70 years or older. These were relatively healthy older adults. They had no previous clinical cardiovascular disease, no diabetes, and no dementia. The mean age was 74.7 years, and about 52% were women, and approximately 40% were at least 75 years of age. That's particularly useful. It's exactly the age range where clinicians have historically had the least randomized evidence. Participants were randomized to atorvastatin 40 milligrams daily or placebo, with a median follow-up of about 5.9 years. And these weren't patients with extraordinary high cholesterol. Mean baseline LDL was about 127 milligrams per deciliter. So this actually looks quite a bit like older primary prevention patients many of us see every day. So STARI asked two different questions, and this is important for understanding the results. STARI didn't simply ask, does atorvastatin prevent cardiovascular events? It also asked a much broader geriatric question. Does starting a statin help older adults live longer without dementia or a persistently physical disability? So the investigators had two primary outcomes. The cardiovascular endpoint included cardiovascular death, non-fatal myocardial infarction, stroke, or coronary revascularization. The other primary endpoint was disability-free survival, survival without dementia or persistent physical disability. And those two endpoints gave us different answers. The cardiovascular endpoints, clearly positive. Let's start with those outcomes. Major adverse cardiac events occurred in 6% of the patients receiving atorvastatin versus 8.3% receiving placebo. The hazard ratio was 0.7 with a 95% confidence interval. That was approximately 0.61 to 0.82. And the results were highly statistically significant. So atorvastatin produced about a 30% relative risk reduction in major cardiac events. In raw numbers, there were approximately 297 cardiovascular events with atorvastatin versus 412 with placebo. That's not a subtle difference. Now let's translate that into something we can actually explain to the patient. The crude event rate was 8.3 versus 6%. That's an absolute difference of about 2.3 percentage points, roughly over 6 years. Very roughly, that means treating around 40 to 45 similar patients for approximately 6 years to prevent one major cardiovascular event. Recognizing that a formal timed event number needed to treat calculation isn't exactly the same as just simply dividing the crude event rate difference. For healthy 72 to 75 year olds or 75 year olds who may have another 10, 15, or 20 years of meaningful life expectancy, that's clinically relevant. But what was actually prevented in this particular trial? This is another important nuance. The benefit was primarily a reduction in non-fatal cardiovascular events rather than dramatic mortality benefit, which we often see in trials. And sometimes people hear that and say, well, did the statin really matter? Absolutely. Preventing a myocardial infarction matters. Preventing a stroke matters. Preventing a coronary revascularization matters. Think about an MI at age 76 could mean hospitalization, PCI, dual antiplatelet therapy, potential bleeding, loss of functional capacity, cardiac rehabilitation, additional medications, potential development of heart failure, maybe loss of independence. And all the things combined, you think about that with social determinants health and access and ability to get care. So even if we don't dramatically expand or extend lifespan, preventing a cardiovascular event can substantially change how those remaining years are lived. And that brings us to STARI's second primary outcome, disability-free survival, neutral. That was what we saw. The composite of death, dementia, or persistent physical disability occurred in 12.8% with atorvastatin versus 13.6% with placebo, hazard ratio 0.94, and that difference was not statistically significant. So atorvastatin did not significantly improve disability-free survival. At first, that may seem contradictory. If we're preventing cardiovascular events, shouldn't patients live longer without disability? Not necessarily, and this is where competing risk becomes incredibly important in older adults. Approximately 80% of deaths in STARIs were from non-cardiovascular causes. A statin can reduce atherosclerotic cardiovascular events, but it can't prevent every cancer, it can't prevent every cause of dementia, it can't prevent every type of infection or hip fall or fracture or eliminate frailty, it can't even remove other age-related illnesses. So as the patient gets older, cardiovascular risk exists in an increasing complicated landscape of competing risk. And that's one reason reducing cardiovascular events may not automatically translate into statistically significant improvements in overall disability-free survival. What about the cognition? This deserves specific attention because patients ask about it all the time. One of the persistent concerns surrounding statins is cognition. Patients will tell us, I've heard that statins cause memory loss, or I don't want to take something that's going to increase my risk of dementia. STARI gives us additional randomized reassurance. There was no convincing signal that atorvastatin increased dementia or cognitive decline sufficiently to worsen the disability-free survival endpoint. So I think that gives clinicians another useful piece of evidence when addressing statin reluctance. Rather than dismissing the patient's concerns, we can say we actually have randomized data in almost 10,000 older adults followed for about 6 years that the study did not demonstrate the feared increase in dementia. That's a much more productive shared decision-making conversation. What about safety? And safety is obviously critical when we're talking about starting preventative therapy in someone in their 70s and 80s. The question isn't simply, does the medication work? It's, does the expected benefit justify the treatment burden and the potential adverse effects? Overall serious adverse events were similar between the two groups, approximately 2.7% in each group. There were some increases in musculoskeletal, hepatobiliary, and diabetes-related adverse events with the atorvastatin, which we've seen in some instances, but there was not dramatic muscle toxicity signals that some patients, and frankly, some clinicians, might expect in an older population. And there's an important clinical lesson here. Many older adults already have arthritis, back pain, neuropathy, shoulder pain, muscle aches, and limited mobility. If someone starts atorvastatin and reports muscle discomfort 6 months later, temporal association alone doesn't prove causation. Evaluate it. Look for alternative explanations. Consider a temporary interruption if necessary. Rechallenge. Try another statin. Use a lower dose. Consider combination therapy, but don't automatically label that patient as permanently statin intolerant. Time to benefit does matter. One of the most clinically useful concepts for SARI is time to benefit. The cardiovascular curves didn't immediately separate. The benefit occurring became increasingly apparent at approximately 2 years. That matters enormously in an older adult when you think about things. Imagine two patients. Patient one is 74 years of age. They are active. They exercise. They're cognitively intact. They're independent. And they may have another 15 to 20 years of live. Patient two is 89. They have advanced frailty, multiple serious illnesses, limited life expectancy. Those patients can have the exact same LDL cholesterol, but the preventative decision is completely different. For the first patient, waiting 2 years for cardiovascular benefit is entirely reasonable. For the second patient, the treatment may never have enough time to prevent meaningful benefit or provide meaningful benefit. So SARI shouldn't create another arbitrary age cutoff. It should move us forward, life expectancy versus time to benefit. There's a much more sophisticated way to think about preventive pharmacology. What about patients older than 75? This is another useful finding from the study. Approximately 40% of SARI patients were at least 75 years old, and the cardiovascular benefit appears broadly consistent across age groups. There wasn't evidence that statin therapy benefit suddenly disappeared once someone crossed their 75th birthday. Again, age is a risk factor. Age is associated with competing risk, but age alone doesn't automatically determine treatment. So what does SARI not tell us? SARI does not mean everyone over the age of 70 should receive atorvastatin 40 milligrams. There was relative healthy community-dwelling adults. These were in the trial. They did not have established cardiovascular disease. They did not have diabetes. They did not have dementia. This is not necessarily the same population as an 87-year-old nursing home patient with advanced frailty, multiple chronic diseases, or extensive polypharmacy. The decision still needs to incorporate cardiovascular risk, life expectancy, frailty, polypharmacy, kidney and liver function, medication tolerance, and patient preference. So what does this do in my practice, or where, how am I thinking about it? For me, the biggest shift is straightforward. Age by itself is no longer a good reason to withhold statin therapy for primary prevention. If I'm talking to a healthy 76-year-old with elevated cardiovascular risk, I can now say something more concrete. We have randomized evidence of almost 10,000 adults over 70 that atorvastatin reduced major cardiovascular events by 30% over approximately 6 years. But then I would give them the absolute numbers. About 8 out of every 100 people receiving placebo experience one of these events, with about 6 out of 100 in the atorvastatin group. That's shared decision making. And then I'd add, the treatment didn't clearly help people live longer without dementia or disability, so the primary benefit we're talking about is reducing cardiovascular disease, MI, stroke, cornea procedure. That's an understandable trade-off. In the pharmacy perspective, there's also a broader pharmacy lesson here. When we talk about medication optimization in the adults, the conversation frequently focuses or thinks about deprescribing, and appropriately so. But deprescribing doesn't simply mean minimizing the number of medications. The goal isn't fewer medications. The goal is the right medications. At the same visit, I might recommend discontinuing an unnecessary proton pump inhibitor, an ineffective supplement, a duplicative therapy, or a medication with substantial anticholinergic burden, and also recognize that the patient's untreated hypertension or LDL represent a preventable cardiovascular risk. That's thoughtful geriatric pharmacotherapy. So this leads us into the next trial, both REACT and Munson. And this is where I think the ESC prevention story becomes really interesting. SARI tells us about prevention can remain beneficial even in surprisingly late in life. REACT is going to show us that atherosclerosis begins surprisingly early. And Amundsen asks, why, after a patient finally has an MI, will it still take months to achieve lipid goals? Put these three studies together and the message is powerful. Atherosclerosis is a lifelong disease process, and that time to exposure is a big deal. We may be starting prevention too late, we may be stopping prevention too early, and after an event, we may still be intensifying therapy too slowly. Keep that in mind as we move to the next study. So let's talk about REACT. What if risk scores are missing the disease? REACT asks an almost philosophical prevention question. In cardiovascular medicine, we estimate risk, age, blood pressure, cholesterol, smoking, diabetes, and then we calculate the probability that someone will develop cardiovascular disease. But what if instead of estimating whether atherosclerosis might be developing, we actually looked for atherosclerosis? REACT evaluated more than 16,000 adults without known cardiovascular disease using advanced vascular imaging to look for silent atherosclerosis, and the prevalence was striking. More than half had evidence of subclinical atherosclerosis. Even some very young adults had a detectable disease. And by later adulthood, atherosclerosis was extraordinarily common. Importantly, some people considered relatively low-risk traditional risk factor approaches already had significant plaque. Why does this matter? Because risk factors and disease aren't exactly the same thing. LDL cholesterol is a causal risk factor. Blood pressure is a causal risk factor. Smoking is a risk factor. But atherosclerosis is the disease we're ultimately trying to prevent. Two patients can have similar traditional risk factors and dramatically different plaque burdens. Now, REACT does not mean we should perform coronary CT angiography or vascular imaging on everyone tomorrow morning. Screening is only valuable if identifying disease leads to an intervention that improves outcomes enough to justify the cost, radiation exposure, incidental findings, and downstream testing and potential anxiety. But REACT reinforces an important biological concept. Cardiovascular events is often the final chapter of disease that has been developing silently for decades. Which brings us to Ann Munson. After an MI, why are we still waiting? If we ask whether we're identifying disease early enough and demonstrates we may be missing the mark because some of the scores aren't completely tracking, and Munson asks whether we're treating established disease aggressively enough. In this trial, they enrolled 2,000 patients after acute myocardial infarction undergoing PCI. Patients were randomized to immediate evolocumab 140 milligrams every 2 weeks plus standard of care or standard of care alone. And here's what made this study unusual. The first dose was given before PCI. Think about that. Not 6 weeks later, not after the first lipid clinic visit, not after the insurance authorization 3 months later, in the actual MI setting, essentially in the cath lab pathway. At 1 year, the combined LDL goal, a LDL below 55 milligrams per deciliter and at least a 50% reduction from baseline was achieved in approximately 82% with immediate evolocumab versus 40% with standard of care. At 6 weeks, the LDL was approximately 16 milligrams per deciliter with evolocumab versus 56 milligrams per deciliter with standard of care. 16. That is an extraordinary lower number. But the clinical endpoint at 1 year of death and unplanned cardiovascular hospitalizations was not significantly different. Approximately 14.6 versus 15.4%. And that does not mean early LDL lowering failed. I don't think it's an appropriate conclusion. Atherosclerosis develops over decades, and the trial may not have been long enough to truly understand what this is after that dramatic lowering. So we need longer term data, and that data is coming in another trial. The real Munson story, though, may be the control group. And this is what I found particularly important. The patients weren't lost in routine clinical practice. They were enrolled in a clinical trial, they had follow-up, the clinician knew their LDL targets, and yet only about 40% of the standard care group achieved an LDL target. That's not failure of pharmacotherapy. That is an implementation failure. We have high-intensity statins, we have ezetimibe, we have PCSK9 inhibitors, we have inclisiran, we have bempedoic acid. The problem is increasingly not, can we lower LDL? The problem is, can our health system reliably get the patient to goal? And that theme is going to come back later when we discuss EMAIL-HF, ADHERE-ASCVD, and TIME-HF. Let's transition now to the anticoagulation space and talk about ENRICH-AF. And this is anticoagulation after intracerebral hemorrhage. Now let's move to one of the most difficult risk-based decisions in cardiovascular medicine. A patient has atrial fibrillation, they have substantial thrombotic risk, but they've already experienced an intracranial hemorrhage. Do you restart anticoagulation? ENRICH-AF randomized 950 patients with AF and previous intracranial hemorrhage to edoxaban and no oral anticoagulant. The average participant was in their late 70s. Stroke or systemic embolism occurred in approximately 11.8 with edoxaban versus 12.8 without anticoagulation, and there was no statistically significant difference. But major bleeding did occur more often, 11.6 with edoxaban versus 5.2 without anticoagulation, almost as twice as frequent in this particular clinical trial. And while edoxaban reduces ischemic events, that advantage was clearly offset by its stroke risk from that standpoint. The lesson, don't simply look at whether anticoagulation prevents ischemic stroke. Ask, what is the patient's net clinical benefit? Enrich AF does not support routinely starting edoxaban in an unselected population of AF following intracranial hemorrhage, but it also does not mean every patient should permanently avoid anticoagulation. The location and mechanism of the previous hemorrhage matters. Cerebral amyloid and neuropathy matters. Blood pressure control matters. Time since event matters. Baseline ischemic stroke matters. And alternatives such as left atrial appendage occlusion may be increasingly important. That reminds about precision antithrombotic medicine and antithrombotic stewardship are key and important. Let's transition to a different versus anticoagulant. And this is looking at a factor 11A inhibitor, Librix-AS. So factor 11 inhibition has generated enormous excitement because of its theoretical promise is compelling. Reduced pathological thrombosis without substantially disrupting physiologic hemostasis. Essentially prevent clots without paying the bleeding penalty. And in this trial, they tested milvexin for acute coronary syndrome with more than 14,000 patients who were randomized to milvexin 25 milligrams twice daily or placebo on top of contemporary antiplatelet therapy. The trial stopped early for futility. Cardiovascular death, MI, or ischemic stroke occurred in approximately 5.4% with milvexin versus 5.1% with placebo. Hazard ratio of 1.05. No efficacy benefit, and intracranial or fatal bleeding occurred in 0.3% in both groups. So we didn't see any enormous bleeding penalty, but we didn't see any cardiovascular efficacy either. Does that kill factor 11A inhibition? No, not at all. ACS may simply be an extraordinarily difficult environment in which to demonstrate incremental benefit when patients are already receiving potent antiplatelet therapy. Trials in atrial fibrillation secondary to stroke prevention may tell us a different story. So I would interpret this trial very specifically is milvexin doesn't at this dose, added to contemporary ACS therapy, did not improve ischemic outcome. That's different from saying the entire therapeutic target has failed. So let's talk about premium and transition to a different ACS-based question. We've spent years shortening dual antiplatelet therapy. And appropriately so, because we just alluded to, bleeding does matter. We've learned that in select patients, aspirin can sometimes be stopped after a relatively short course while continuing P2Y12 inhibitor monotherapy. Premium asks the next logical question, why wait? Could we eliminate aspirin essentially from the beginning? Approximately 2,300 STEMI patients undergoing primary PCI were randomized to low-dose prasugrel monotherapy beginning before PCI or conventional aspirin plus prasugrel. At 12 months, death, stroke, or MI occurred 11.0% in the prasugrel alone versus 8.5% in DAP. Prasugrel monotherapy failed to demonstrate non-inferiority, and MIs occurred in 2.9 versus 1.3% of the population. So there's an ischemic price, but there's also no expected trade-off. Major bleeding occurred in 5.6% of monotherapy versus 8.4% in DAP. Less aspirin produced less bleeding, but it was very early. Highly thrombogenic period after STEMI, the ischemic penalty was too great. The practical takeaway? The movement toward less antithrombotic therapy has limits. The goal isn't as little as therapy as possible. It's the least therapy necessary to preserve ischemic protection while minimizing bleeding. Premium suggests that 0 days of conventional DAP after STEMI is probably too aggressive. Switching to another question in DAP therapy, the Switch Sweetheart trial. Prasugrel or ticagrelor? We've had lots of debates of this, especially after the ISAR-REACT trial. Switch Sweetheart addressed another everyday acute coronary syndrome question, which potent P2Y12 inhibitor should be the default after PCI. This was a fantastic and fascinating pragmatic registry-based policy trial involving more than 17,000 patients. Swedish healthcare regions transitioned from a default ticagrelor strategy to a default prasugrel strategy. At 1 year, death, MI, or stroke occurred approximately 11.1% under prasugrel and 11.8% with ticagrelor. Essentially a similar ischemic protection. Major bleeding, however, favored the prasugrel strategy, but I think there's another important lesson here. The trial demonstrates what a learning health system can look like. Clinical care generates data. Data identifies uncertainty, randomization is embedded into routine care, and the results feed directly back into clinical practice. That type of pragmatic evidence generation may become increasingly important as traditional cardiovascular megatrials become more expensive and difficult to conduct. All right, so let's go to implementation science since we've talked about it. So we'll start out with email HF and we'll transition here. Sometimes the problem isn't the evidence, it's finding the patient. And Wendy have arrived at one of my favorite studies from the meeting, email HF, because the trial deals with the problem every healthcare system have. We have therapies that save lives, but eligible patients aren't receiving them. Email HF used registry data to identify patients with heart failure who are not receiving SGLT2 inhibitor. Instead of waiting for those patients to eventually return to a heart failure clinic, the system proactively reached out digitally and offered access to specialist consultation. Nearly 6,000 patients were randomized. At 6 months, SGLT2 inhibitors initiation occurred in 18.6% with digital outreach versus 8.2% with usual care, more than doubled. There is no statistically significant difference in heart failure hospitalizations or death, but the trial wasn't designed to detect a modest clinical outcome difference from that relatively small absolute difference in medication initiation. Think about what happened. No new drug, no new device, no new biomarker. The healthcare simply used data already possessed to identify patients with a treatment gap. That is population health. A pharmacist should be leading this type of work. Imagine the EHR continuously identifying HFrEF without SGLT2, HFrEF without MRA, HFpEF without SGLT2, HFpEF-AL with non-steroidal mRNA, ASCVD without appropriate lipid-lowering therapy, Lp(a), LDL above the threshold, CKD with albuminuria without appropriate kidney protective therapies, AF without stroke prevention. Instead of waiting the patient to appear in clinic, find the gap, engage the patient, close the gap. That's an entirely different model of healthcare delivery. Likewise, let's transition to adhered ASCVD. Can digital nudges fix statin non-adherence? Adhere ASCVD takes that implementation question one step further. These patients already had an indication for statin therapy. The problem was adherence. Investigators use adaptive digital outreach through email, text message, or secure patient portal communication. And digital outreach improved short-term statin refills, but only modestly. Approximately 14.4% refilled there after digital outreach versus 12% with usual care. So an absolute improvement only a couple percentage points. Is that disappointing? Perhaps, but I actually think it's incredibly informative. Because sending someone a text does not solve medication adherence. Non-adherence isn't one problem. It's a dozen of different problems that produce some observable behaviors that we can identify. Cost, side effects, shared decision-making, nocebo, health literacy, misinformation, transportation, pharmacy access, forgetfulness, competing priorities, distrust, lack of perceived benefit, or sometimes informed decisions that patients simply don't want the medication. And a digital reminder can't solve all of those. The opportunity, though, this is where analytics needs to move beyond identifying non-adherence. The next step is identifying why is this particular patient not adherent. Match the intervention to the barrier. Cost, financial navigation, pharmacist consultation, side effect concern, forgetfulness, synchronization, access, home delivery, misinformation. Do we need to do shared decision making? Now population health becomes personalized. So that is all of the implementation work. I'm very excited about that. But I want to spend a minute talking about some old friends. So let's revisit old heart failure therapy in the modern era, and that's HF and hydralazine isosorbide meta-analysis. So let's turn to heart failure. Hydralazine plus isosorbide dinitrate has a long history in heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. We have historical VHEF experience, and importantly, AHEF demonstrated a substantial benefit in approximately in appropriately selected Black patients with systematic heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. But contemporary heart failure looks differently than those trials, and we have ARNI, we have evidence-based beta blockers, MRAs, SGLT2 inhibitors, and sophisticated device therapy. HF asks whether adding hydralazine isosorbide nitrate provides additional benefit across a broader contemporary HFrEF population. Approximately 600 patients with symptomatic heart failure and reduced EF were randomized to hydralazine plus isosorbide nitrate or placebo, and there was no significant reduction in death or worsening heart failure events. Tolerability was also an important problem, and that wasn't a surprise for us pharmacists. Headache, hypertension, dizziness, multiple daily doses, medication burden, polypharmacy. But let's be careful, please. HF does not erase AHEF. Please note that. It does not erase AHEF. different population, different treatment area, different background therapy, and the company meta-analysis demonstrates substantial heterogeneity across the studies. So the appropriate interpretation isn't hydralazine isosorbide dinitrate doesn't work. It's HF does not support routinely adding hydralazine isosorbide dinitrate across unselected contemporary heart failure reduced ejection fraction populations already receiving modern therapy. That's much more precise, and it illustrates an increasingly important problem. As foundation therapy improves, older medications may provide progressively smaller incremental benefits. So let's talk about metformin and heart failure. Metformin has an interesting history in heart failure. Years ago, clinicians worried about using it at all. Then observational studies suggest patients receiving metformin might actually have better outcomes, but observational associations aren't randomized evidence. And MetHF finally tested this question in approximately 940 patients with HFrEF, diabetes, prediabetes, or elevated diabetes risk, were randomized to metformin or placebo. Mean follow-up years was about 4 years. The primary composite of death, worsening heart failure, MI, or stroke occurred in 25.1% with metformin versus 23.4% with placebo, hazard ratio of 1.10, no cardiovascular benefit, no improvement in mortality, no meaningful improvements in heart failure events. Does that mean metformin is a bad drug? Absolutely not. Metformin remains an effective glucose-lowering medication for appropriately selected patients. MetHF tells us something more specific. Metformin isn't a disease-modifying heart failure therapy. Contrast that with SGLT2 inhibitors or GLP-1 inhibitors. The benefit with HFrEF occurs regardless of diabetes status. That's what true HF disease modification looks like. That's an important distinction. And let's move to time HF. What if the most powerful heart failure intervention isn't a drug? Now let's talk about time HF again, or as I alluded to. I want to spend some time here because I think it may be one of the most important implementation trials at ESC. Time HF randomized 1,500 patients with heart failure with reduced ejection fraction across multiple centers in India. The intervention wasn't a new medication. It wasn't a device. It was a nurse-led collaborative care model supported by mobile health technology. The intervention incorporated patient education, self-care support, active follow-up, medication optimization, and longitudinal outpatient monitoring. After 2 years of survival without hospitalization was approximately 84% with collaborative care versus 79.4% with usual care, and the mortality was reduced by approximately 22%. Think about that. A healthcare delivery intervention produced a mortality benefit. Why is this so important? Because we often talk about implementation as it's somehow less scientific than pharmacotherapy or other interventions, but imagine the best heart failure drug ever developed. Hazard ratio of 0.70. Incredible. But the patient never receives it. What's its hazard ratio for the patient? 1, no benefit. Time HF reminds us that delivery is an important part of therapy. You can have the best therapy. I always say this. You can have the best intervention in the world, but if it doesn't get to the patient, it doesn't matter. So what is the pharmacist's opportunity? Now take the time HF concept and think about what it could look like with pharmacists embedded in the care model. Pharmacist-led GDMT, remote blood pressure monitoring, renal function surveillance, potassium monitoring, SGLT2 initiation, MRA initiation and titration, ARNI initiation and optimization, medication reconciliation, adherence assessment, diuretic management, even using subcutaneous furosemide, under protocol, patient education. This is not replacing a physician. That's allowing every member of the cardiovascular team to practice at the top of their training. We simply don't have enough heart failure specialists to personally manage every medication titration for every patient with HFrEF. Team-based care is not an option anymore. It's an infrastructure. And finally, let's finish with structural heart disease. At CASA, Atavia evaluated antithrombotic therapy following transcatheter aortic implantation. One ongoing concern after TAVI or TAVR is hypoattenuated leaflet thickening, imaging consistent with subclinical thrombosis on bioprosthetic valves. Approximately 360 patients were randomized to non-vitamin K agonists or DOAC, direct-acting oral anticoagulants strategy, or aspirin. At 12 months, hypoattenuative leaflet thickening occurred in approximately 6.2% with anticoagulation versus 28.6% with aspirin. So anticoagulation substantially reduced this imaging-related leaflet thrombosis. The safety of composite bleeding, thrombotic events, and death was approximately 7.5% with anticoagulation versus 10.6% with aspirin. and there was a more intriguing mortality signal favoring anticoagulation. But this is a relatively small study that needs to be interpreted cautiously. The bigger question is, does reducing subclinical leaflet thrombosis actually improve stroke, valve durability, reintervention, heart failure, or mortality? That's the question that matters, and it's become increasingly important as TAVI moves into younger patients. If someone receives a TAVR at 65, we may need that valve functioning for decades. If subclinical thrombosis contributes to structural valve deterioration, preventing it could matter enormously. But we've learned repeatedly that improving imaging surrogates do not automatically mean improving patient outcomes. So this trial is very provocative. It's hypothesis-driving, but I wouldn't use it tomorrow morning to anticoagulate every patient after TAVR. So what connects all these trials and that large data dump I just did? Now let's zoom out, because when you look at days 2 and 3 together, I think there's a coherent story. Theme 1, atherosclerosis is a lifelong disease. Starry tells us prevention remains effective later in life than our evidence base previously allowed us to confidently say. REACT tells us atherosclerosis begins much earlier than most people recognize, even with risk factors and scoring, and that we need to be thinking about this time to exposure hypothesis. And Munson tells us that after the patient finally has an event, we're still often too slow to achieve those lipid targets and need to be more aggressive with this. And put those together is we may start prevention too late, stop prevention too early, and intensify secondary prevention too slowly. That's a powerful message. Theme 2, more therapy is not automatically better. Enrich AF, more anticoagulation reduced ischemic events but produced too much bleeding in a population with intracranial hemorrhage. Librex ACS, another antithrombotic mechanism, didn't improve outcomes. HHF, adding another vasodilator regimen across unselected modern heart failure reduced ejection fraction population didn't provide clear incremental benefit. MET-HF, a familiar metabolic therapy, didn't become a heart failure drug simply because observational data suggested benefit. Sometimes residual risk isn't solving by adding another medication. Theme 3, less therapy isn't automatically better either. Premium provides that counterpoint. Yes, aspirin causes bleeding. Yes, shorter DAP strategies are attractive. But eliminating aspirin immediately after STEMI increases ischemic risk. The goal isn't more therapy, and it isn't less therapy. It's the right therapy for the right patient for the right duration. Theme 4, surrogates aren't outcomes. Munson produced extraordinary LDL reduction, but did not significantly improve clinical outcomes at 1 year, and maybe the trial was not long enough. Escasa TAVI reduced subclinical leaflet thrombosis, but we don't know whether that translated into better patient outcomes. Biomarkers and imaging are useful, but ultimately patients care about living longer, disability, avoiding a minor stroke, remaining independent, and feeling better. Never confuse impressive surrogates with outcomes we're actually trying to prevent. And theme 5, my favorite and most important, implementation is treatment. And this may be the biggest takeaway from the entire meeting. Email HF identified untreated patients in more than double SGLT2 in initiation. Adhere ASFD showed that digital outreach can improve statin refilling, but also showed that simple nudges won't solve complex adherence problems. Time HF demonstrated that structural technology-enabled collaborative care can actually improve outcomes. These aren't secondary stories. These are central to modern cardiovascular medicine. We don't need another randomized trial proving SGLT2 inhibitors work. We need every eligible patient to receive one. We don't need another study proving LDL causes ASCVD. We need health systems capable of identifying uncontrolled LDL and doing something about it. We don't need another guideline telling us 4 pillars of heart failure reduced ejection therapy works. We need care models with the team and pharmacists embedded capable of getting patients onto 4 pillar therapy quickly and safely. The next revolution in cardiovascular medicine may be much more about implementation science as drug discovery. What should pharmacists do Monday morning? Here's my takeaway. So let me get this very practical. After ESC trials, I think pharmacists should ask 5 questions. Number 1, are we identifying cardiovascular risk early enough, and are we continuing prevention long enough? Starry and REACT challenge both ends of our traditional prevention timeline. Number 2, are we treating aggressively enough after event? And Munson should make us uncomfortable with waiting months to get LDL controlled after an MI, and we need to be aggressive. Number 3, are we balancing ischemic and bleeding risks rather than simply adding or subtracting antithrombotic drugs? The key here is developing antithrombotic stewardship programs. Enrich AF, Librexia, Premium, Switch, Sweetheart, and Acacia's TAVI all reinforce that principle. Number 4, are we distinguishing medications that treat comorbidity from therapies that actually modified cardiovascular outcomes. MetHeF is a great example. A medication can be useful without being a heart failure therapy. And number five, do we have systems that make evidence-based care happen? Again, email HF, adhere ASCVD, and time HF. This is where pharmacists can have an impact and need to be engaged and learn about implementation and how to do it. My final take-home messages so far. If you remember one few things from day two and three of ESC is remember, STARI in nearly 10,000 relative healthy adults age 70 and older, atorvastatin reduced major cardiovascular events from 8.3% to 6.0% over nearly 6 years, a 30% relative risk reduction, but not improve disability-free survival. Age alone should no longer be used as a reason to withhold statin therapy, but you have to put in the risk-benefit paradigm. REACT and shared decision-making. The REACT trial, subclinical atherosclerosis is extraordinarily common and begins much earlier than the cardiovascular events, and our risk scores may not be appropriate at this. And Munson, immediate avilocumab after MI dramatically improved LDL goal attainment, 82 versus 40%, showing us an implementation strategy and how much therapeutic inertia remains in secondary prevention. Enrich AF, routine edoxaban following previous intracranial hemorrhage cannot be recommended in unselective AF populations because of increased bleeding events. Librexia ACS and milvexian did not reduce cardiovascular events when added to contemporary ACS. Premium, eliminating aspirin immediately following STEMI went too far. Less bleeding came at the expense of more ischemic events. Switch Sweetheart, a prasugrel first strategy produced broadly similar ischemic outcomes with less major bleeding than ticagrelor first strategy and demonstrated the potential pragmatic registry based of a randomized controlled trial. Email HF, here ASCVD, and time HF show about the different ways that implementation can be useful and work and how that they have pros and cons and what they need to be done. Email HF, we can improve finding patients and double the use of therapy. Adhere HF, not just improve statin refills, but adherence is way much of a broader, complex topic. And time HF, team-based, technology-enabled collaborative care is key and critical, and we need to expand that. And then finally, HF and MetF, these additional therapies have, you know, balance in our routine modern therapy, and metformin may be still useful for diabetes lowering, but it's not a heart failure drug, and a adriamycin isosorbide, depending on how they are in their contemporary therapy, may or may not be useful. And then Esketatavi, anticoagulation, reduced subclinical leaflet thrombosis compared to aspirin. We need to establish that in a larger trial. If I had to summarize day two and three from Munich in one sentence, it would be the next frontier in cardiovascular medicine isn't simply discovering what works. It's identifying disease earlier, choosing therapy more precisely, and building healthcare systems capable of reliably delivering what already works. That means pharmacology, but it also means population health, it means analytics, it means implementation science, it means digital health. And it means pharmacists, nurses, physicians, APPs, informaticists, and patients working within a system to design, to identify and close treatment gaps rather than waiting for patients to fall through them. And that is a valuable lesson. Sometimes the breakthrough is building a better way to deliver the drugs we already know work. And for pharmacists, I think that's one of the most exciting messages to come out of ESC. And with that, I'm Dr. Craig Beavers, and this has been the Telltale Heart Pharmacist Cardiovascular Digest. Thanks for listening, and please like, subscribe, give feedback, and we'll continue our coverage through the fall of various meetings.